Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, back in studio today. So glad to be here. Bill Gurley's going to be here in a little while. He's a general partner at Benchmark, a leading venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, author of a brand new book, Running Down a Dream, How to Thrive in Your Career That You Actually Love, which is a goal for everyone. And Michael Duran is with us, too, Hudson Institute Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East. And how appropriate is that? So let's get to the big three, and then Michael.
Number three.
I guess the entry thing, I'll be honest and say I've actually been thinking about entry since April 3rd, 2023, when we got assigned to this mission. We've still got two more days. And riding a fireball through the atmosphere is profound as well.
And that's what Victor Glover was talking about, that astronaut we all have got to love, the whole crew coming home. Artemis 2 readies the capsule to re-enter Earth's orbit, and Blue Origin and SpaceX get commands from NASA. Pick up the pace so we can walk on the moon before China.
Number two.
They're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the country July 4th. But that's not our celebration. We were slaves then. So I don't know what everybody getting ready for a celebration.
It was the start of America, where we all are thriving today. It's a journey. We weren't ready to go from day one. Sharpton calls on Democratic candidates to come kiss the ring and pander for the black vote, if they are even thinking of running for office, as New Jersey socialists face major tests for Mikey Sherrill's seat. We have the latest on politics.
Number one.
If Iran wants to let this negotiation fall apart in a conflict where they were getting hammered over Lebanon, which has nothing to do with them and which the United States never once said was part of the ceasefire, that's ultimately their choice.
Well, they have a lot to do with Lebanon because they're trying to destroy it by using a terrorist group called Hezbollah. That is the story that J.D. Vance was talking about. 2 week ceasefire. Iran and U.S. and Israel are perplexing at best as I look at the ceasefire, as Iran thinks it's okay to charge ships for crossing international waters. It's not. And debatable on whether Israel and Hezbollah involved in the stand down notice. I sense where both sides are reloading. Michael Duran is with us right now. Michael, how long do you think this ceasefire lasts? What do you think happens today?
I think it's about a 50-50 chance that it holds. Everybody's posturing right now, especially the Iranians. They're posturing. They're trying to create a victory image, but they may be hurting so badly that they actually want to come to a deal. We won't really know for about another 24, 48 hours. I think by then it'll be pretty clear whether they're negotiating seriously or whether they're just buying time and trying to string us along as they usually do.
So I want you to hear from J.D. Vance, who's going to be leading the peace talks with Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. Cut five.
This is one of the things that's going to be one of the main subjects of negotiation, is that we want Iran to not be able to make a nuclear weapon. We want the nuclear fuel, which is something the president has made very clear. And there, again, the way to think about this is the United States has certain demands and certain things that we want. The Iranians have things they can get out of the negotiation. The more that they're willing to give us, I think the more they're going to get things out of this negotiation.
So they're talking about getting their uranium out, all of it, and reopening up the strait. They have no control of it. both those things that the Iranians say are not on the table. But we don't know what they're saying behind the scenes, Michael. What do you think?
Yeah, we don't know what they're saying behind the scenes. Brian, when I was worked in the White House under George W. Bush, I was always amazed at the distance between the public posturing of the Iranians and what they said to us privately. They're very clever. They do it for a reason. They're trying to sow dissension in our ranks, divide us from our allies, and so on. And we don't really have any solid information, except President Trump said to the media yesterday very clearly that the points that you're reporting on from the Iranians are not the points that I have in front of me.
I mean, the 10 points I saw yesterday were comical. I mean, they're just a joke. We want the U.S. out of the Gulf states, out of the Middle East. We're going to be charging for the Strait. We want money for all the damage you did to our country. I mean, it was just I stopped reading after five. So yeah, the president said that's not the 10 we looked at.
Exactly. It's totally a joke. And you can see, look, they're trying to say, the Iranians are trying to say that Hezbollah, a ceasefire by Israel against Hezbollah, was part of the deal. President Trump has said that wasn't the case. J.D. Vance has said that wasn't the case. The Iranian media said, well, then we're not going to come to the negotiating table. But I woke up this morning to read that, well, they are going to show up in Pakistan for the negotiations. So clearly that effort to claim that Hezbollah was part of the deal and that they'd pull out if they didn't get it failed.
So here is what General Keane said the plan is with the uranium. Cut 17.
Well, I wouldn't have done what we're doing. I wouldn't have gone to the ceasefire because I think we should take control of the Straits of Hormuz ourselves. But here's where we're at. We're there, and we got to deal with where we're there. And listen, the president has said time and time again, we have very strong conditions. The president is not going to take a bad deal from these guys. You know, that's just a fact. There's no way he's going to let these people enrich, and there's no way he's going to let them keep the enrichment that they already have.
And he likes what you guys did with the Bush administration. Cut 18.
The plan on the table, Bill, is you let us come in there and take it out of there, just as we did in Libya many years ago during the Bush administration. We moved the Central Intelligence Agency in there, and they extracted the nuclear program. And that is what's on the table for us.
So those are two things that are going to happen. I guess it all depends, Michael, on how much damage has been done to Iran. We know they lost countless numbers of their government, just eliminated.
Yeah, the thing with the Iranians, though, is that they are willing to fight until their last civilian is killed. And they the Iranians, Hamas, Hezbollah, they use our own civilized instincts against us. We don't like to see civilians killed, so they put civilians between themselves and us, and rely on our own morality to allow them to win. So it's hard to know, though. Iran is not Hamas. This isn't. It is a huge country, 93 million people. It's now a dictatorship of the IRGC. There's no real civilian oversight over them. Their own population hates them. They repress them brutally. So how long they can hold out like this, extorting the world over the Strait of Hormuz because they have this drone and missile capability, is not clear to me.
So the president's getting worried because, you know, the gas prices, oil, energy, you know, 890 ships outside the strait. So you can't blame him for getting concerned about that, right?
No, and he's concerned about that. He's concerned about the fact that the Iranians still have this missile capability and drone capability, and they're willing to hit desalinization plants all around the Gulf, the entire Gulf infrastructure. He knew that he could go and win and take the Strait, as General Keane said, but that there would be a large price to pay for that. And some Americans would die, but also a lot of destruction of the oil infrastructure of the whole Gulf. He decided to stop and see if he can negotiate an end here. The four things that we need to be concerned about are the uranium, the missiles and drones, the proxies, and the Strait of Hormuz. And the we can judge the quality of the deal by how many of those items Donald Trump is able to force the Iranians to deliver to us.
So Netanyahu's goal is a little different. He wants to make sure Iran is no longer a threat. And he also wants to make sure that Hezbollah and Hamas are no longer a threat. And both those things, so are they both are still threats, not as big as they were. Here's what Bibi said yesterday through a translator, cut eight.
As you all know, a temporary ceasefire came into effect tonight, a two-week one between Iran and the U.S. in coordination with Israel. No, they did not surprise us at the last moment. And I would like to emphasize, this is not the end of the campaign. It is merely a preparation on our way to achieve all of our goals.
So could there be a problem when we end? Or do you think these two get along so well, they understand each other and the politics we're both dealing with?
No, I think they get along very well. And Israel is also the junior partner, and Netanyahu knows that. Netanyahu is never going to fight with Donald Trump. You know, there'll be friction, little disagreements like there are in any marriage or any friendship. But Donald Trump is the leader of this coalition. The Israelis know that very, very well. They're enormously thankful for the opportunity that Trump has given them to diminish their enemies like this. Enormously thankful.
So, Michael, we had Dennis Ross on, and he said he believes like 9 or 10 months after the fighting stopped, he thinks the Iranians are going to overthrow their own government because of the damage that we've done and the people that we've killed. Do you have a hope? I know you have hope, but do you think the same thing?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't like to predict those kind of things because there's two things that I have not yet seen, despite all of the opposition to the government. I haven't seen a serious split in the security services of the Iranian government, and I haven't seen protesters who are able to take any kind of four-star asset and hold it, you know, like a radio station or a parliament or something like that, a provincial government. Until I see something like that, I'm not going to say that we're on the verge of revolution.
What do you think about NATO's stance in all this?
Look, it's disappointing that our European allies do not see the work that the Israeli and American alliance is doing for the entire West. If Israel and the United States didn't go and diminish the Iranian threat, then Iran had the ability, we can see right now, to control the Strait of Hormuz and through the Houthis to control the Bab al-Mandeb, one-fifth of the entire energy supply of the world. Imagine, Brian, that we went to war with China over Taiwan, and the Chinese, working with the Iranians, shut down all of the oil resources going to East Asian countries, because that's what this system is all about. Ultimately, it's behind the Iranians stand the Chinese. The Chinese have built up in a clandestine way. They provided the materials to the Iranians to build up this missile system that they have.
Yeah. So I guess we're going to see what's going to happen with Israel, because I think they're having the same headwinds as President Trump is here. Because I see Bibi Netanyahu is being heavily criticized by the opposition, as is Democrats heavily criticizing Trump. When our enemies see that, many don't understand our system, that's almost part of our system, you know, democratic system. But Iran looks at that and says, oh, these guys are coming apart.
It's always the case when we're dealing with the authoritarian leaders. They see democratic dissension as a sign of weakness, and they miscalculate. It's one of the fundamental advantages that we have ultimately against our enemies. It can be at certain moments when you see the Chinese and propaganda building up the propaganda of the domestic enemies of our leaders. It gets scary at certain moments, but ultimately it's our strength.
Yeah, I want you to hear some of that opposition. Cut 26.
A two-week ceasefire, especially one as fragile as this, is not a strategy.
We have a completely unhinged president who is threatening massive war crimes.
He starts a war, backs down, then declares it a victory for world peace.
So, go ahead.
Look, there's a coalition out there today of the Chinese, the Iranians.
Yes.
Bernie Sanders, Chuck Schumer, Tucker Carlson, and then in Israel, Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, the enemies of Netanyahu. Everybody who's got Trump derangement syndrome, everybody who's got Bibi derangement syndrome, they're all, plus our external enemies, they're all on this line that this is a great strategic defeat, and it's just false. Look at all of the destruction of the really four-star assets that the Iranians have, that they have to now rebuild that. How are they going to do that? You can't live on jihad and air. You have to have an economy.
That is so funny. Michael Turan, thanks so much. It's going to be interesting 2 weeks. Hopefully we'll talk to you again.
Great. Thank you.
You got it. So we'll look at the middle of a ceasefire. We'll see how long it goes. Number one, you got to open up the strait. I'm talking about you need over 100 tankers to go through there. That means business as usual. Got to happen. And tell me how we're getting the uranium out. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
When I heard the Pentagon briefing this morning, first Secretary Hegseth and then General Kane, they both acted as if they think the war is basically over. Something has occurred that we don't know the details of that has given this administration, the president included, high hopes that Iran has blinked here, and that while a ceasefire may take a little while to settle in and become effective, that there's a real chance of a negotiated settlement along our terms. I think it remains to be seen whether that turns out to be true, but I think that's what they think.
I just think there's, and Bridium, that's what I think too. You got to read between the lines, and the vice president knows what goes on, and the president saw enough of the 10-point plan to say, okay, there's a reason why we could stop fighting and maybe give the Strait a chance to open and see where we go from here. Plus, the president's anxious to get our economy back going again, right? So I understand that. But if we leave with the uranium there and the Strait under Iran's control, it's going to be looked at as a failure. And I think not a failure, but falling way short of why the president took on this titanic effort, which even his former vice president, famously, these two had a huge falling out with Mike Pence. He was just on with me on television and just saying that he couldn't be prouder of the president for doing this, because he knows in the Middle East, you can't get anything done permanently as long as that terror regime is in place. So that's what Brit Hume's saying. Something must have happened. So remember, they had an offer. You can go ahead and enrich outside the country. If you really want nuclear energy, and I doubt they do, but if you really want nuclear energy or nuclear medicine, enrich outside the country. I actually don't think they do. You think they care about the environment? They live on an ocean of oil. There's one thing, there's two things that I think surprised to the degree of the president and his staff. I don't think they were going to be able to shut up the Strait of Hormuz. They did. We have a plan to open it up. It's going to take a toll. It's going to be hard, but I think we have to do it ourselves. The other one is they didn't think they were going to be rocketing the Gulf states because they didn't want to alienate the Gulf states. They wanted to win them over. And when they started rocketing them as late as yesterday, still you have statements from them, not U.S., we need more interceptors, not the U.S., what have you dragged us into? It is, not only do we want the U.S. here, we want to expand their presence in the area. And what did one of the Iranians demands? That we evacuate the Middle East. We heard that for a long time. Saddam Hussein did the same thing. We end up with a bigger footprint. But controlling the Strait, I know the president came out and said, yeah, maybe we will control the Strait along with Iran. Come on. The president just riffing on that. There's no substance to that at all. We come back, Bill Gurley joins us, general partner with Benchmark, author of Running Down a Dream, How to Thrive in a Career You Actually Love. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You're in 11th grade right now, and you're a third year of college. What would you be telling that young man and woman to focus on?
Learn how to think. Learn how to think for yourself, be independent, have a little grit, have a little courage. Read everything. Don't get weaponized by the left or the right. Be smart, have a heart. Be part of a team as opposed to, you know, pound your chest and be about yourself. They're going to have more jobs than we ever did. You know, they're going to probably have more flexibility over time. They'll have a great career. The notion that productivity in the United States is going to go down, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is jobs will change over time.
That is Jamie Dimon on with us, talking about some career advice for people in this generation who are changing careers or just breaking in and starting one. Bill Gurley has the same approach, a general partner at Benchmark, a leading venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, author of a brand new book, Running Down a Dream, How to Thrive in a Career You Actually Love. Bill, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. Hey, appreciate it.
Bill, how long did it take you to find a career you loved?
It took about 6 years from college, I guess. I worked as an engineer for 2 years, realized that wasn't. So that was my undergrad degree, was computer engineering. Worked as an engineer for 2 years, realized that that wasn't what I wanted to do the rest of my life. Went to business school, went from there to Wall Street. So I guess it's going to be more like 7 years. Right. And then I worked on Wall Street for 4 years before I made my way into venture capital, which I would definitely declare was my dream job.
So your game plan was just go out and find something. No specific. Go find something you really loved and you could excel at the same time.
Yeah, I don't view either the first two stops as something that was negative. It was just I came up with this heuristic that I think a lot of people could use, which is. After a couple of years in the role, I asked myself, is this something I want to do for the next 30 years? Like, do I see myself? And in both those cases, there were people in the organization that were lifers that I could look at and imagine myself and say, is this going to be me? And I realized it wasn't me. So I took a pivot and went in a different direction. I think young people should be very comfortable trying to recognize if they're in a place they don't want to spend the rest of their life in. Life gets really short very quickly. It seems like you're going to live forever when you're 23, 24. And by the time you're 40, it's pretty clear that's not going to happen.
Right. So, and you had certain things you did along the way. You don't regret trying to find your way through that, through the maze to find out what you like. Are you trying to give people a shortcut? So it wouldn't take 6 years to find out what you're going to like, or is it necessary for everyone to find their way?
Yeah, so the book's divided into two pieces, profiles and principles. So we have stories of success and tools of success. And the first tool is called Chase Your Curiosity, and it's about trying to find this thing that you're truly fascinated by. And I think there are certain people who know that at 11 years old, and there's some people who don't find it till they're 40. And if you don't have it, I borrowed from a lot of the people that the greats that have written in this category, but a ton of different exercises you can do to try and find that thing. The real test, I think, the greats in every field tend to be continuous learners. They're people that are just so fascinated by what they do that they study it constantly, not just at the beginning of their career, but beginning, middle, end. And I don't think you can have that level of studiousness if you're not fascinated by what it is. You just get bored. And so, and look, we've taught a whole bunch of children how to grind. Like starting in sixth grade, everybody's worried about what college you're going to get into. And we start packing the kid's resume and we pack their schedule and they grind and grind and grind and grind. We used to let them pick, or we used to tell them they couldn't pick their major until their end of sophomore year in college. Now, a lot of schools, you have to apply to a major, as you apply to the college. So you're now 17 and people are like, what do you love? What are you going to do the rest of your life? And they just get into the system and they're running. And there's not a lot of time for reflection as to what is it that you truly love. I also think many well-intentioned parents, counselors, advisors, you know, can't help but worry about economic stability, which tends to push people towards safe careers, so-called safe careers. And AI is now making some of those safe careers not so safe.
So they say AI right now, on average, is taking 16,000 jobs per month over the past year. So that's really, you know, these are usually high educated people who expect to get a good entry level job. Even Jamie Dimon was telling us last week that those jobs are being taken up by AI, a lot of the analysts and some of the entry level work.
Yeah, and there's others, paralegals. I think there, I've met many partners at law firms that have already, you know, drastically pared back the number of paralegals they have. So, yeah, I didn't write this book. I started this book way before LLMs took off, and I didn't write it to be a solution for that. But what I would tell you is the rote algorithms that you learn in college, those are all in the models. So if you're not the type of person who's so hyper curious that you're living on the edge, I think you're at risk. Now, if you are a paralegal and you work with 30 other paralegals and you're the one that knows AI the most, you're going to be safe. And so as a side note, unrelated to the book, I think for everyone, you know, if you want to protect yourself against AI, you want to be the most AI enabled version of yourself you possibly can be.
Right. Bill, don't you somehow, like, if people love their job, but they know after working 40 hours a week, they're still not able to make ends meet, what role does that have to play in loving your occupation? If you're going paycheck to paycheck, yet you love going to work every day, can you still be happy?
Yeah, I don't know how many of those people they are. I mean, these Gallup poll surveys show only 23% of people, you know, self-identify as engaged and thriving at work, and the rest of them, you know, are fairly ambivalent about what they do. And what I found, most of the stories in the book involve people that are in careers your parents would tell you not to go into. And what I found is that when people are truly fascinated in high agency, they tend to do so well in their job that they don't struggle financially. But I just don't know how many people are in a job that they don't, that they think they love, but just don't make money.
So, I mean, if it's easy to figure out when you're at 23, you have a job you don't like, you keep moving occupation. So there are things you could do in school to get you ready. So at 22, 23, when you get out, you're pursuing something you potentially could make your life work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real test is, like, what are you fascinated by? A number of the people we studied actually ended up pivoting into their hobby, you know, but because that's the thing that they spend so much time on. When I was an engineer, I was at home at night. I had started trading stocks. I had learned how, I had read Peter Lynch's book, One Up on Wall Street. I had this Value Line subscription, and I was studying stocks, and it should have been a clue to me that that's where I was going to end up going. And so, like, really getting in touch with the thing that you're fascinated by, because then you get this self-perpetuate machine where you're just going to constantly be ahead of everybody else. And another way to think about this, if you're in a career that you don't really love and there's somebody else that has that fascination, they're going to outrun you. Like, they're going to outrun you. They're going to outperform you in interviews. They're going to crush it, and you're not.
So, you know, you picked Uber ahead of time, Zillow, OpenTable. You made some good bets early on. Is that the fun of it? The competing to find out what the next big thing is going to be?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that drew me to venture capital. One, I really adore technology. I like understanding technology. And so new technologies, you know, are ways that new startups are able to succeed. And so that was fascinating to me. I like business strategy. I learned that at business school. You know, when I was 18, we would go to Vegas and count single deck blackjack. And so I kind of like gambling a little bit. And all those things are kind of present in the venture game.
Right.
And being able to make a, I remember when we backed OpenTable, there were three restaurants, and, you know, we got to 20,000. And I remember being in Bali and going in a restaurant and seeing the device on the table. And that's, you know, having made the bet when there were three and then seeing that, that's rewarding for me.
And you look at some different people that have had successful, like Mr. Beast. Tell me about Mr. Beast.
Yeah. So one of the principles in the book is to embrace your peers, which is something that I don't think a lot of people talk about. When Jimmy Donaldson, Mr. Beast, was 17, he was trying to basically reverse engineer the game of YouTube. You know, how can I be most successful at YouTube? And that was all he was fascinated by. His parents wanted him to go to college, but he just loved this YouTube thing. He found three other people that were equally interested in YouTube. And so they would be on it. He claims they were on a Skype call like 16 hours a day for 4 years. And he also says, he said they all ended up making over $1 million. And he said, if a fifth person, random person, had been on those calls, they would have made $1 million too, because they were at the forefront of this new thing. And mm-hmm. the expertise they were sharing with one another wasn't zero sum. They could all go execute against it and rise and thrive together. And we have a number of stories in the book about people that have done this successfully, like, and, you know, in your line of work, I mean, do you spend time with people that do what you do other companies and other firms?
Absolutely. Yeah, you compete though in certain times, but I think it's so widespread. I think you always collaborate too. You also mentioned Bobby Knight, what he did to become the smartest basketball coach around during his generation.
Yeah, the Bobby Knight story, the early days of Bobby's journey, he was, I think, the most aggressive mentor pursuit story I've ever seen. And so he identified who the top 10 coaches were in college basketball, and he kind of ruthlessly pursued it. Like, he drove, in one story, like, drives 3 hours to a conference where he knows this coach is going to be, and then just tries to hustle to sit next to him at a table so that he can get to know him. But he did this like 10 different times. He'd show up at a coach's house in one thing, he showed up with like 150 plays on different note cards and asked the person to go through them with him, which seems maybe a little over the top, but most people wouldn't know that about his early journey, just how much he learned from the greats and how aggressive he was about pulling that off.
Bill Gurley's with us now. He has written the book, Running Down a Dream, How to Thrive in a Career You Actually Love. Bill, the other thing is, it's just amazing how diverse the people you decide to feature are. And I think the overriding theme is you got to be aggressively pursue what you like if you don't know. So even if you're eliminating things, that's progress.
No doubt. No doubt. There are other techniques in the book. There's a gentleman that runs the Acquired podcast. He came up with this idea of a side hustle. He said, if you're at an employer, ask them if in your spare time you can do something else. So now you're running two experiments rather than one. The employer, in his case, always viewed it as the individual being productive and trying to add value. So it looks positive on you anyway, but then you get to do another thing. And he started this thing called Microsoft Garage while he was at Microsoft that gave him exposure to venture capitalists. One of them ended up hiring him. When he was at the venture capital firm, he said, do you mind if I start a podcast as a side hustle? They said, sure. Of course, that ended up being his dream job. And now he does that full time.
Right. And Jeff Bezos, I know he's on the back of your book, and he said he was reading it, and one of his comments was, I started taking notes right after chapter one. And that backs up your other point, is that you're always learning. I mean, Jeff Bezos pretty much doesn't have to worry about money for generations, right? So he's trying to learn. Yeah. It doesn't stop.
It doesn't. And I fear, Brian, that we've created such a gauntlet of kind of sixth grade to end of college that these kids are exhausted and they come out thinking, oh man, I'm so done learning. I'm ready to go work. And, you know, for the best in their field, they just never stop learning. You know, they just are constantly, there's a story in the book I love where Kobe Bryant is 2009. He's already won 4 championships. And in the offseason, he calls Hakeem Olajuwon, who's been out of the league for 10 years, and says, can I fly down to Houston and spend 2 days with you and work on learning your footwork in the post, which is not a position Kobe plays. Like, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And then he won his 5th championship the next year. But like, that's a level of obsessive learning, you know, for someone who was considered one of the best of all time.
Yeah, the arrogance has no place with your methods.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And in fact, things like embrace your peers is kind of, it kind of requires this lack of belief that it's a zero-sum game, that my win is your loss, this kind of whole sharp-elbowed attitude that I think some young adults, I think, come out with that mindset because they competed in athletics, so they have this notion that there's a winner and a loser. But in most career fields, there's a ton of winners. And so if you can get out of that notion of being, like, I'm not saying don't be competitive, because, like, I'm certainly competitive, but don't think that I have to win at someone else's expense.
I love it. Yeah. Bill, definitely a worthy book. Every college kid has got to grab it and understand it's a journey and it's a pursuit. You're not going to wake up in the morning and just decide, this is what I'm going to do. You got to pursue it and go find out. Bill Gurley, congratulations on running down a dream, how to thrive in a career you actually love. Bill, thank you.
Thanks for having me on. And as you mentioned, young kids, the graduation's upon us. So this is
perfect timing.
A graduation gift.
Perfect timing. Career Services does not do enough for these guys getting out of college. It makes no sense to me. Bill, thank you very much. Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Just me and you talk.
Just you and me.
Yeah. You run a re-election, and if you were re-elected, are you considering running for president?
Just you and me.
Just me and you. Just between us.
Look, we have, I think, some incredibly talented folks in the Democratic Party. And what I think we are poised to do, if we have this national referendum in the midterms, and if people show up in record numbers, we have an opportunity to have a real debate within our party about what we stand for, about what our affirmative vision is, which can't just be about banging Donald Trump every day. It has to be about what we are going to do to make people's lives better.
Well, that's a start. I have not heard from anybody else. They're still saying impeachment, 25th Amendment, stop Donald Trump. We got to get his people into court and prosecute him, and Pam Bondi. I mean, that's basically Governor Shapiro talking to Al Sharpton. He's got his big meeting now. Al Sharpton has every Democratic candidate who wants to run in 28 was asked to come and invited if you're interested in coming. And if you want to come and say you're not going to run. But he also talked about how powerful Kamala Harris is. I know Pete Buttigieg is going. Ro Khanna is going. Andy Beshear is going. And then I guess Al Sharpton is going to pose, you know, I guess compose himself as a power broker there. And then see, they're all going to say reparations in America is a horrible racist place, because I hope they don't, but I'm afraid they are. By the way, if you want to check me out on stage with History of Liberty and Laughs, going to morph into Uniting the States, go check me out on BrianKilmeade.com. Next date, May 30th, Reno, Nevada. Then July 11th, Pensacola, Florida. And in October, Red Bank, New Jersey.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world, where they decided to drop a ball like it was New Year's Eve on July 3rd to 4th, right, at midnight. But get this, the mayor is not going to let the people come because he doesn't want big crowds gathering during the World Cup, which is odd. Is he afraid of people enjoying themselves in a big picture? Scotland wants to come watch a game. They can't get tickets. They go to a place like New York City. Is that a bad thing? I don't even get it. There's some say it's because of cops. They need more. Okay, hire more cops. You have money in the budget. You just don't like cops. Big three.
Number three.
I guess the entry thing, I'll be honest and say I've actually been thinking about entry since April 3rd. 2023, when we got assigned to this mission. We've still got two more days, and riding a fireball through the atmosphere is profound as well.
Coming home, Artemis 2 readies the capsule to re-enter Earth's orbit, and Blue Origin and SpaceX get commands from NASA, pick up the pace so we can walk on the moon before China and before Trump leaves.
Number two.
They're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the country July 4th, but that's not our celebration. We were slaves then. So I don't know what everybody getting ready for a celebration.
because that was part of the pathway of being American. Sadly, that was a part of our past, but there would be no America if there wasn't a 1776 Al Sharpton for you to thrive in. Sharpton calls on Democratic candidates to come kiss the ring and pander for the black vote. If they're even thinking about running for office in 2028, who shows up? We'll go over it.
Number one.
If Iran wants to let this negotiation fall apart in a conflict where they were getting hammered over Lebanon, which has nothing to do with them and which the United States never once said was part of the ceasefire, that's ultimately their choice.
But it has a lot to do with them because they sponsor Hezbollah has taken over Lebanon in order to bomb Israel. 2 week ceasefire. Iran and U.S. and Israel perplexing at best so far. As Iran thinks it's okay to charge ships for crossing international waters, it's not even debatable on whether Israel and Hezbollah are involved. I don't think either one of them are going to stand down. What does that mean for the overall plan? Well, right now it looks like oil is back to $100 a barrel, so it's up slightly, but down from where it was about 110 the other day because people doubt whether it's going to hold or not. Yesterday, only four ships went through the strait and all paying about $2 million to get through, which is crazy. It's extortion. You should not be doing it. So it's going to be J.D. Vance, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner meeting one-on-one with Pakistan as mediator with the Iranians. What's left of their brain trust and how much power they have? I mean, the president is not a powerful position inside the Iranian government. Well, the Ayatollah, the son of the Ayatollah, is incapacitated. I sense a coma or already dead. So you're left with the IRGC leaders, many of which have been killed already. So we'll see where all this goes. General Keith Kellogg weighed in about the ceasefire. Cut 10.
Is the war over with a big U.S. victory?
You know, Larry, it's good to be with you. Look, no, it's not. We're in a two-week period that's going to be really interesting to watch. From the Iranian side, there's four people really involved in this. You've got the Supreme Leader, Khamenei. You've got the leader of their parliament, Kaliba. You've got the the Revolutionary Guards Corps commander, Vahidi.
And he's going to be there. The question is, are they all going to agree? Because these Revolutionary Guard guys are fanatical. And that's why most of them have been killed. And they just keep fighting. They're taking orders from anyone. They're spread out through 31 provinces across the country. And then you wonder, you know, Israel's got their agenda, and I thoroughly understand it. They got to make sure they can live in peace with their reluctant neighbors. That's Hezbollah and Hamas. Hamas is enjoying the time away from the spotlight. They're about to get a lot of scrutiny as soon as this is ended. And they can't get rocketed from Iran, who's financing Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, Hamas, and everybody else. They lost Syria, and now the president wants to make sure that they have a shot at the Middle East, and it cannot be with a Islamic extremist Iran. It just can't be. You could ignore it. You could put sanctions on it, but you can't say that it's ever going to get better, especially when you see the rocket technology that they've put together. And they use Russia, North Korea, and China to help them build it. Here's what General Jack Keane is against this, but says here's where we go from here. Cut 17.
Well, I wouldn't have done what we're doing. I wouldn't have gone to the ceasefire because I think we should take control of the Straits of Hormuz ourselves. But here's where we're at. We're there, and we got to deal with where we're there. And listen, the president has said time and time again, we have very strong conditions. The president is not going to take a bad deal from these guys. You know, that's just a fact. There's no way he's going to let these people enrich, and there's no way he's going to let them keep the enrichment that they already have.
So what do you think? 1-866-408-7669. We're going to get some calls in. I also want to talk about politics a little bit, 26 and 28. I don't think the House is lost. We've got to see what happens when how the economy recovers as rapidly as it could once this conflict ends, if it ends the right way. And the president will have momentum from Venezuela, Iran, and possibly even Cuba, by the same time getting everything going with the gas prices and with the economy and with jobs. But in Virginia, for example, Governor Spanberger, now if she caught fire as a moderate, that might lead the pathway to say, look at Josh Shapiro, look at Bashir, look at Spanberger, so-called moderates, lean left, but not crazy left, and look at the success they're having. But Spanberger has been anything but. She builds herself in one way, and now she's turned out to be in the other way. Get rid of ICE. Let's do redistricting. Let's not explain to people what you're doing. And if you look at approval ratings, he's down to 46%. Compare that to other governors. Northam had 48% at this point. Terry McAuliffe, 52. You had George Allen. Remember, he was going to run for president. 67% approval. And even Glenn Youngkin, in a minority state, mostly Democratic state, Glenn Youngkin was close to 60% approval rating. I mean, that's somebody who actually knows what he's doing. He just wants to be competent. And I think that's important. What you got to find out, too, is the whole socialist wing. They got to worry about the podcasters on the extreme right and saying crazy things about Charlie Kirk's death and everything else, and foreign wars and misstated facts coming out of these podcasts. That's what Republicans have to worry about, okay? But with Democrats, they got to worry about the crazy. And I think this mayor in New York is one of the crazies. And so is the Democratic candidate on the left going to replace Mikey Sherrill, who went on to become governor. I mean, look at some of what she has said in order to get elected. So you have this woman's name is Analia Mejia. She backs abolishing ICE, Medicare for all, no exemptions, expanding the Supreme Court, impeaching Justice Thomas and Alito. Can I ask you why? But don't let me slow you down. $25 minimum wage, tuition-free college, essential health care for transgender people. Okay, as lefty as you get. Is that person going to be successful? As opposed to the Republican, a former mayor who calls Mejia a socialist, label she rejects despite ties to Bernie Sanders and AOC. Longtime organizer of the Working Families Party, a pro-choice moderate, is running for law enforcement, ICE reform, job growth, lower taxes. That seems to be reasonable Republican. MAGA maybe doesn't love him, but Republicans would. Is this going to blow the seat? And if it blows a seat like Mikey Sherrill's seat in New Jersey, that'll be a warning sign for people to say, listen, there's just no place for the extremists in my party. But right now, no one's adhering to it. They're saying whatever happens, happens. And the ones that aren't crazy left, like Ro Khanna, are acting crazy left. 25th Amendment, impeach Trump, Epstein files, start a war to avoid the Epstein files. I mean, this guy was supposed to be reasonable, taking on Governor Gavin Newsom and talking about how he's chasing businesses out of the state. Well, now listen to him. Look what he's saying. Cut 31.
We need to remove this president. We need to use all options, whether it's impeachment, whether it's the 25th Amendment. The reality is he's threatened war crimes. He has undermined everything this country stands for. He's threatening to wipe out another civilization.
Yes. Donald Trump, he's always politically correct. Number two is, if you're going to say war crime, what has Iran been doing? Rocketing civilian infrastructure in all the Arab, in the Gulf states. Now, let's prosecute Donald Trump, Ro Khanna. I think the Iranians are just misunderstood. And Bill Clinton was basically bombing Serbia's infrastructure. I don't think any Republican or Democrat was saying this guy's committing war crimes. I didn't think so. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think I'm wrong. But that's all they're talking about, impeaching again. And that should be what Republicans run on. Oh, if you put the House and put the Democratic hands, they're not going to say we got to make things affordable. They're going to say, let's get Donald Trump. And they're going to say, let's impeach Donald Trump. And guess what? Then there's a trial and they sit there without Trump there. He does his job and everything stops. And Democrats and Republicans go back and forth on how great and how bad Donald Trump is. That's what you want to do. 1-866-408-7669. I'll take some of your calls. Well, we'll do that when we get back. We'll talk about those two things. And then Artemis is going to be returning home tomorrow, depending on what location you're in. This has been a spectacular voyage that they've been on. Everybody I know is talking about it. How do they keep the momentum going? We're moving up all their dates to getting people back interested in space. I love it. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I guess the entry thing, I'll be honest and say I've actually been thinking about entry since April 3rd. 2023, when we got assigned to this mission. And one of the first press conferences we were asked, what are we looking forward to? And I said, splashdown. And it's kind of humorous, but it's literal as well, that we have to get back. There's so much data that you've seen already, but all the good stuff is coming back with us. There's so many more pictures, so many more stories. And gosh, I haven't even begun to process what we've been through. We've still got two more days. And riding a fireball through the atmosphere is profound as well.
Victor Glover, such an impressive guy. He's impressed the whole world in his conversations that he's having, whether it's the President of the United States or with Fox News or some other channel. Just doing a fantastic job as he gets ready for splashdown tomorrow. What have they done? Successfully completed a crewed deep space mission around the moon, the deepest ever. Tested critical systems, future missions, life support and crew operations beyond low Earth orbit. Navigation and communication system provided valuable data to support safe future lunar landings. What they're also doing is telling SpaceX and Blue Origin to develop lunar landers quickly in time to test them on Earth orbit next year and ultimately deliver astronauts to the lunar South Pole in 2028 while President Trump is still in office. And look, even if you didn't vote for Trump, he's the one who's putting all this emphasis back in the space program that all of you seem to be enjoying so much. Ralph, you're in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Ralph.
Well, good morning, Mr. Kilmeade. My concern was the blue wave supposedly coming up. Right. Now, we got Vermont will never be a Republican state. But the idea is there some way we can galvanize the Republicans from around the states to push, just get out, so we can at least mitigate this blue wave thing, because it's going to be ferocious.
Maybe not. It depends on what happens with Iran. And remember, this is April, and we got until November. And then we saw the job numbers 1 week, boom, huge. And then if you get through this Iran thing, and it ends the right way with the Iranian being given up and the strait being opened up, with them having no control over it. And then you start moving forward with all your economic principles and plans, and people get their they'll get their returns back. And you have Democrats who continue to say Donald Trump is bad, 25th Amendment, impeachment. Where's their plan? Listen to Harry Enten on CNN, Cut 33.
Look at these shifts. Okay, and I want to put this into a historical perspective for you. Dems liberal exceeding the previous presidential vote. So in 2025, 2026 cycle, we're talking about exceeding Kamala Harris. Look at this. We're talking about exceeding Kamala Harris, the liberal candidate, did by 21 points. 21 points. And this is part of a pattern, right? In Virginia governor, we saw the Democrat there exceeding Kamala Harris by 10. New Jersey governor by 8. And this is even better. Even better than what Democrats had back in the 2017-2018 cycles, where they were exceeding Hillary Clinton's baseline, but by 12, 4, and less than a point. So this time around, oh my goodness gracious, holy cow, holy smokes, holy Toledo. And of course, remember, Democrats took the House in 2018, and I will note that Wisconsin Supreme Court performance last night by Chris Taylor was the best for a liberal candidate in an open seat in at least 30 years.
There you go. Okay. So, by the way, Marjorie Taylor Greene's seat did not flip. 10-point win for the Republican takes over. Gary in Daytona, Florida. Hey, Gary.
Hey, good morning, Brian. No, to touch on the last caller, I heard James Carville try to dismiss. He was confronted with the fact, does it really hurt these candidates standing on stage with these nut jobs that hate America and are viciously anti-Semitic? And he tried to blow it off. And they actually, these candidates seem to embrace being on stage with people who are from the river to the sea and hate America and don't want us to win in Iran.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And what's happening, and it really bothers me. So if someone like Nick Fuentes, who's a famous and proud white supremacist who loves Stalin and Hitler, and you go, well, he's got a lot of followers, I don't agree with everything. No, you don't appear with him. Now, the president made a big mistake, didn't know anything about him when Kanye West, who he thought was semi-normal and isn't, shows up at Mar-a-Lago. The president was like, wouldn't even say, oh, I had lunch with him, no big deal. Never talked about him again. And of course, he's turned on the president, like just as you would expect. And now this other guy comes out and people are in Michigan like, no, well, I'm not into cancel culture just because he thinks the Holocaust was a hoax and doesn't like Israel. What's the big deal? I mean, it's a huge deal. And no doubt about it. There was a time when Al Sharpton was somebody no one should ever appear with. But now he's got everybody showing up. The other guy, Zoran Mamdani, if I'm a moderate, I'm not appearing with him. But this guy has got 48% approval rating. 100 days in, he was celebrating himself. And he also has something else that's back to the future. Cut 29, his racial equity plan.
Now, the racial equity plan for which we are currently taking public comment, it will only further this work that is already underway. It will put the goals of 45 city agencies under one racial equity framework, allowing us to better focus our efforts against a crisis. Now, we know that all of New York City is facing the crisis of cost. We also know that that crisis is not born evenly. From 2000 to 2020, more than 200,000 black New Yorkers were pushed out of this city.
That's right.
Because they could not afford living in the most expensive city in the United States of America.
So who's staying here? You're taxing the rich, so they're leaving. And then you say it's too expensive for the poor. Well, you're subsidizing housing, you're blaming landlords, you're telling them to fix everything for free, and then you're upping taxes on people. So big businesses and corporations with the responsibility to shareholders like Jamie Dimon saying, I got more people in Dallas now because they want me to stay there. This guy has no concept of somehow you have tax incentives to bring companies here. When you get more employees, they get bonuses, they get paid. You can tax them proportionally, and then they begin to thrive. Do you understand that? They just don't want to play it out. They'll say things like, trickle-down economics doesn't work. It's not trickle-down. It's an economic principle that Adam Smith talked about. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we talk more about what's happening over in Iran. Get a perspective on how the Trump administration plans are coming out on top. Don't move.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What we know is that the United States accomplished its military objectives. What we know is the United States could have imposed significant additional military and economic costs on Iran and still has the capacity to do so. But we think, thankfully, at this point, I think, have a ceasefire thanks to the leadership of the President of the United States, the Iranians promising to open the Straits of Hormuz, and we have a negotiation that's supposed to start this weekend. That's the truth. I think it's a good first step.
There you go. That is the vice president who's going to be, surprisingly for me anyway, is going to be leading the delegation, I think at the request of, and I don't think the president has a problem with it, at the request of the Iranians, along with Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, as they go into another negotiation here about how this all ends. What did we see yesterday? A ceasefire that said open up the strait and stop hitting the Gulf states. They never stopped hitting the Gulf states. In my view, they said, well, that's because Israel keeps hitting Hezbollah. And I could play a clip, and I'll just tell you, J.D. Vance said that's never been brought up in the ceasefire negotiations, Israel at all, with Hezbollah. Just Israel stopped hitting Iran. So the strait closed. Only three ships got through. They all paid $2 million as a toll. That can't stand in international waters, period. You don't think China's going to be cashing in on that? Plus, think about it. A weakened country like that charging tolls for a strait that doesn't belong to them? So today, I understand, according to our reporters, none of the Gulf states have been hit. And we have not hit Iran. Okay, this is a start. I will say that Hezbollah has hit the northern part of Israel. Jonathan Rue joins us now. His latest column, he's a fellow for the American Strategy at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. Jonathan, welcome. What's your take so far on day two of a ceasefire?
Thank you for having me. Well, so far, I think everything remains up in the air. President Trump did everything he could to get a ceasefire. And one of the ways he did that was to leave the tough negotiations to this 2-week period. So I think right now, as expected, we're seeing the Iranians try to claim victory and use this to browbeat the Trump administration into giving up America's objectives when we went to war in the first place, which is to remove a lot of these Iranian threats. So a lot remains to be seen. But right now, Iran's doing exactly what I expect them to.
And right now, they're evidently a different posture behind the scenes in that they're saying publicly. Is that true to character?
Yeah, certainly. They're great at talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're great at using war to negotiate, and they're great at using threats to go back to war as part of their negotiating strategy. So, you know, I expect them to try to dig in their heels as much as possible and test U.S. resolve.
And so far, Donald Trump says we're keeping our military assets there. We're watching everything, and we'll see what happens on Friday, Saturday. But when he says Israel's not part of it and they say he is a part of it, how does that get resolved?
Well, I think it gets resolved by a tough U.S. negotiating posture. The Iranians are going to try to find weakness wherever they can, and already claiming that, that Lebanon was supposed to be part of the ceasefire is exactly true to their playbook. They're going to see if they can get the U.S. To buckle on that, because they want the U.S. and Israel to be at loggerheads with each other rather than a unified front against Iran, because Iran knows, they saw from the last 5 weeks, when the United States and Israel are on the same page, it imposes a lot of serious costs on the Iranians.
I know. And do you believe that how much damage do you think is done to that government and to that country?
So on a military level, an incredible amount of damage. I wouldn't say complete victory, but this is why it's a ceasefire. This is not a complete end to the war necessarily. Hopefully negotiations can get the bit that was not accomplished during the war. But if you look at it, we saw General Kane lay out a lot of this yesterday. Iran's leadership has been destroyed several times over. They're trying to put new people in place. They're trying to act defiant to compensate for that fact. Their missile capabilities have been seriously degraded. Their nuclear program remains largely entombed or destroyed. So I think Iran's capabilities have taken a major hit. It's their intentions that I think are unchanged. They want to show that they won, and they're willing to keep fighting, even if they've lost a lot of military capability.
And Jonathan, they had the foreign minister and the speaker in their crosshairs, did the Israelis. And then it looks like the Pakistanis reached out to the U.S. and said, can you not kill these guys? Because they're the only guys we're dealing with. Number one, do you think that story's true? I have no reason not to think it's true. And my problem is, if they're the so-called reasonable extremists, do they really have control if they do cut a deal with what's left of the IRGC?
That's a million-dollar question. I've never heard that term before, but reasonable extremists is the best description I've heard of what a lot of people want to call moderates in the Iranian regime. That's an oxymoron. The foreign minister, the speaker of the parliament, they're as hardline as anyone else at this point, and they reflect the fact that it's the IRGC that's really running the show behind the scenes. Even the new supreme leader is IRGC affiliated, if he's indeed still able to make decisions in any sense. So, I think the real question is, if there is a deal, or if there's a coherent Iranian negotiating posture, it's going to represent some combination of the various views of a lot of people who are all IRGC affiliated. And so, the fact that I think Iran was able to implement a ceasefire at this point, to agree to one and then to observe it even after some of the attacks you described at the outset, suggests that the functionally the IRGC is in control now.
So in terms of the U.S. and Israel, and having different goals, through a translator, here's the Prime Minister of Israel, cut eight.
As you all know, a temporary ceasefire came into effect tonight, a two-week one between Iran and the U.S. in coordination with Israel. No, they did not surprise us at the last moment. And I would like to emphasize, this is not the end of the campaign. It is merely a preparation on our way to achieve all of our goals.
Wow. Your thought about that, because the Prime Minister does have separate objectives. That's not a secret.
Yeah. And, I think that message is one the Iranians need to hear from both the United States and Israel, which is this may be a ceasefire. A ceasefire is an opportunity for Iran to negotiate peacefully for a lot of the objectives the United States and Israel went to war. But ultimately, if Iran wants to do what it usually does in negotiations, try to drag them out, split the United States away from its partners, things like that, then this, those 2 weeks will be up very quickly and we'll resume. We tried diplomacy with the United States and Israel, and it didn't work. So back we go to Operation Epic Fury and Roaring Lion.
So, Jonathan, have you heard about any type of cohesive, coherent, open up the strait military operation that the U.S. would probably have to employ in order to do it. And we're probably going to have to do it ourselves. And when it comes to escorts, initially, we'll probably have to do that ourselves, too. Do you think that's where this is heading? Because I do.
I would honestly, I think that's the best of all options at this point, if given the fact that Iran has made clear that they view the strait as theirs, even though that's, you know, illegal under any interpretation of international law. It's going to take the U.S. showing that it can sail through Hormuz at will, that the U.S. Navy still can control the Gulf. Iran does not run it. Iran cannot threaten international shipping. That's ultimately what it's going to take, because as long as there's even a small threat of one more Iranian drone or mine hitting a ship that tries to go through, or otherwise those ships have to pay millions of dollars to get through, the strait will not be reopened in any meaningful sense that's going to help the global economy.
So I want you to hear General Keane. He said this is the deal that we should be offering them. Cut 14.
What we should do right now is issue an ultimatum to them based on the 2 weeks. Iran, you meet our conditions, and we know what those conditions are, and the president wants to make them public once again. Make them public. And if you don't meet our conditions in 2 weeks, then we're going to reattack.
Very simple. And that could be, that's the statement that should be part of Friday's talks, don't you think?
Yes, that's, I mean, you watch the Obama administration, the Biden administration, they never understood that basic equation, that the only way to get Iran to negotiate in earnest is to give them the clear alternative of military action. The United States has shown now that it's willing to carry out those threats. Iran has to factor that in. So that message should be front and center and repeated at every single possible point throughout the negotiations. And if Iran, as I expect, still tries to drag its heels, you actually have to resume and carry out those threats.
All right, Jonathan Rue, do you think this is a 1 or 2 day or 3 day series of talks? What do you project?
I hope it would be only that, because my expectation is the Iranians are going to try to either drag these out, which they always do, and basically try to erode this resolve, these threats that we just heard, try to get the United States and Israel to argue with one another, and then go from there. And then potentially, the entire time, Iran's going to be making a lot of money charging tolls through Hormuz. So I worry a two-week ceasefire becomes 4 or 6 week and on and so forth.
Can't let them do that. All that money is used for no good. Jonathan Rue, thanks so much for your perspective. Appreciate it. We come
Thank
back.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. You'll finally get to see what I look like if you watch FBN.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We're going to do a hit on FBN. You get to see a simulcast. If you're watching the stream, that's great. You can go to BrianKilmeadeShow.com. Also, we always have the YouTube channel. You can watch afterwards, but now we usually do a simulcast. When Stuart's ready, we go and find out what's on his mind, and then you get a chance to hear what's on his show, and they get a chance to see what we have coming up on our show. Afterwards, I always can squeeze in some calls right at the end, or you can write me at BrianKilmeade.com. So make sure you do that. So we'll make sure we do that, a simulcast. So let's listen
in. It's 10:51. Kilmeade arrives on the right-hand side of the street. It is now 10:51, and here he is. All right, Brian, welcome back to the show. Trump critics are flip-flopping over Trump and the Iran war. Watch this.
It was the Taco Tuesday of all Taco Tuesdays, as our president decided not to drop the chalupa for at least another 2 weeks. This is how it goes every single time. Trump says something insane, we all freak out, and then he backs.
Trump is backed off, and there will be some who will call it, you know, taco. Yeah. Right? Trump always chickens out, which is making way too light of it, but it is also a truth.
President Trump's critics have coined the acronym TACO for Trump always chickens out, referring to previous threats that he's pushed back.
Let me repeat that. Taco, Trump always chickens out. All right, Brian, let me get this straight. They, Democrats, fearmonger the war, and then they get upset when Iran isn't annihilated. Can you make sense of this for me?
No. I mean, put it this way. It's an acronym they stumbled into. Do you remember when Joe Biden came out and thought he was going to neutralize Trump and his supporters by mocking MAGA? And everyone said, no, that's what we call ourselves. Make America great again. That's fine. Then he wants to use this taco thing to make Donald Trump, I guess, lose his base or lose support. But if you think about it, Donald Trump says, when I come into office, I'm going to reorganize trade. Did he do that with Liberation Day? Absolutely. Like it or not. Did he say that Venezuela will not stand as a state that's destroying our border and putting TDA in our country? Absolutely. What happened? Maduro's in a Brooklyn prison. Does he putting in all types of pressure on Cuba, have it fall from the inside out? Yeah, it's in the process. Did he go ahead and take on Iran after 47 years of terrorizing America? You might not like any of those moves. But what I just described to you is a president following through on everything that he said.
Yeah, he does stuff. He does it. He says it and he does it.
Yeah.
Tell me, what did Biden actually do? What did he say and then do it? I can't remember much at all.
Well, put it this way. Remember, he said, don't, Iran. They continue to. Remember, he told Saudi Arabia that you're a pariah nation and said the Houthis, you're no longer terrorists. How did that work out? Saudi Arabia gave Biden the stiff arm, and the Houthis started rocketing and shutting down the Red Sea. And did Iran run to the table for a new nuclear deal? No, they mocked him as he looked the other way. I should do this. Look the other way and avoided sanctions where most of the oil then went to China. Would have Trump come in, started stressing them again, shutting them down those different pathways, bringing this whole thing to fruition, at the same time bombing out their nuclear program, delaying it. And now it's up for us to go get the uranium out of there and reopen that strait. This is a presidency of consequence, nonstop. Whether he's reinvigorating the space program we're all witnessing right now, starting the Space Force, which we're in the middle of and we've accepted right now. President of the United States going 100 miles an hour. Also trying to fix college sports. Joe Biden was a one issue a month guy who spoke extemporaneously for 12 minutes a week, and none of which were to Fox reporters.
Yeah, they're mocking Trump and forgetting Biden. That's a fact. Next up, Brian, after 100 days in office, new polling shows 48% of New Yorkers approve of Mandama's performance. That, by the way, is lower than the early numbers for former Mayor Eric Adams. How do you grade Mandama's first 100 days on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being fantastic?
Well, put it this way. Eric Adams, who, you know, he was riddled with unfavorables, marginalized by his own party at the end, still at 60% approval rating. So Mandama's down to 48%. Remember, he was running against another Democrat, an invisible Republican, but running against another Democrat and was not able to get 50% of the vote. So this is par for the course. But he even told Politico, I'm not going to be able to get free buses. He told the governor, you got to raise taxes. The governor says, I can't really do that. He told everybody that he was going to bring racial equity into the fray when it comes to New York City. He said he was going to clear the snow off the streets. We had to wait for this thing called spring to get our snow off the streets. He has been terrible at that. What he's finding out is being a 34-year-old who's good on social media is a lot easier than being a mayor. And I think the future of the party, and they look at him as the future of the party, if he is successful, it's bad news for the Democrats. The best thing for Democrats is for the socialist / communist to fall flat on his face, freeing up the center left side, like the Governor Shapiro's of the world, and Rahm Emanuel's, to run as traditional Democrats against traditional Republicans.
Okay, I take your point. I don't want him to fall flat on his face. I've got to live here. Brian Kilmeade, thank you very much indeed, sir. You know, we'll see you.
We'll see.
Still ahead.
182. He was, sadly, I don't think he had, Stuart Varney has a vote here. He has a vote. I can't vote here because I live in Long Island, but Stuart Varney has a vote, but it didn't count because this guy won. And he falls flat on his face. He's going to be neutralized by doing what? Diminishing the cops. We're 6,000 short. We have a police commissioner that he's slowly trying to de-emphasize. We know her as Jessica Tisch, the police commissioner, who's done a great job, but for the most part has been battling a mayor as long as she can keep on to the job. I had a chance to talk to her 2 weeks ago. And to me, my interpretation, she didn't say this, someone who's holding on for the good of the city. But when she goes and he puts another one of his radical lefties into power, that's when all hell breaks loose. And we're also seeing a lot more homeless. Remember, leave the homeless encampments up. How did that go? Got a lot of death and destruction. Just a quick note. I'm excited about Uniting the States, a brand new book to look back at what made our country great in six pivotal moments in our past that I think really separate us from everyone also and made us the country we are today. I'm going to be talking about that on stage in Red Bank, New Jersey on October 16th, Westbury, New York on October 17th, Clearwater, Florida, November 7th, on the 8th in Jacksonville, and the 21st just outside St. Louis in Chesterfield, Missouri. And don't forget November 30th, Reno, Nevada, and Pensacola, July 11th. BrianKilmeade.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. 1-866-408-7669. Busy hour. Of course, we're following all the events happening as the President of the United States makes it clear. Our military is not going anywhere. And just so happens we're right now giving peace a chance, or peace talks a chance, ceasefire talks a chance. Bottom of the hour, Buck Sexton joins us, co-host of the Clay and Buck Sexton Show and host of the podcast Buck Brief, author of a new book, Manufacturing Delusion, How the Left Uses Brainwashing, Indoctrination, and Propaganda Against You. Karl Rove will be with us. That has not worked against him, safe to say. Let's go to the big three.
Number three.
I guess the entry thing, I'll be honest and say I've actually been thinking about entry since April 3rd, 2023, when we got assigned to this mission. We've still got two more days, and riding a fireball through the atmosphere is profound as well.
There you go. That is Victor Glover coming home. Artemis II readies the capsule to re-enter Earth's orbit. This is the most challenging and the most exciting. We'll keep you up to date.
Number two.
They're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the country July 4th. But that's not our celebration. We were slaves then. So I don't know what everybody getting ready for a celebration.
Yeah, well, it's the birth of the country, Al. I don't know if you heard. Sharpton calls on Democratic candidates to come kiss the ring and pander for the black vote if they're even thinking for running for office. And as New Jersey socialists face a major test for Mikey Sherrill's seat, we have the details.
Number one.
If Iran wants to let this negotiation fall apart in a conflict where they were getting hammered over Lebanon, which has nothing to do with them and which the United States never once said was part of the ceasefire, that's ultimately their choice.
That's the vice president who's going to be leading the ceasefire talks beginning tomorrow. Former deputy chief of staff and senior advisor to President George W. Bush joins us now to talk about what's going to be happening there. Karl Rove, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, do you think it's the right choice to have the vice president lead these talks? I think it is. Good test for him, too.
Well, a good test for him, and it shows that, you know, sending the vice president of the United States sends a very strong message about the importance to which this administration has for these conversations. No, I thought it was a smart move. And look, I thought it was also very, very good of him to lay down right from the beginning, we're not going to let you expand this list of demands. He knows exactly why Iran is concerned about this. Hezbollah is one of their leading terrorist tools, and they want to keep that tool in the you know, working for, on their behalf in bedeviling Israel and threatening it from the north and the west. So yeah. No, smart on his part.
So here we go again with the Strait of Hormuz. Right now, it looks like there's just a few tankers getting through there, and they're paying extortion to get through. I mean, that obviously can't stand, Karl.
No, it cannot stand. Look, we one of the fundamental principles that we have stood for as a country since the beginning is the freedom of the seas. And it was important to us as a young nation, and it's important to us as the world's strongest economy. We cannot allow to establish the principle that rogue nations like Iran, who have the ability to project their power over a key waterway, can somehow turn that into a revenue source and hold the world economy at risk.
So when if you're the president of the United States, he came out and said, let's make it clear, you know, our military is ready to go and where we stand to take action. How do you feel about the way NATO's Mark Rutte, General Secretary, came out looking to mend fences? Where's NATO at right now in your mind?
Well, remember, we have a couple outliers like the Spaniards. But most of the NATO countries lived up to their responsibilities to allow U.S. flights over their territory, allowed U.S. bases in their countries to be used for staging material and personnel for the conflict in Iran. So I think we got to be very careful. Remember, the president sort of started off saying, we don't need NATO in this. We got it all. And now he's saying, well, you didn't do enough to help us. So a little bit of the confusion is, you know, Mr. President, you sort of told us at the beginning you didn't need us. No consultation beforehand. Didn't expect him to have consultation. And they have indicated a number of them to be willing to participate in the efforts to open and keep open the Strait of Hormuz. So I think the president ought to, you know, find a way to sort of signal to the Spaniards, I didn't like that, and you're going to pay a price. But he ought to recognize that we have valuable allies and they can be of great assistance to us. But he needs to consult with them and draw them in and give them a seat at the table, not expect them to come running like, you know, some waiter in a restaurant whenever he decides that he needs them, particularly since he said, I don't need their help at the beginning.
Well, a couple of things. I think I agree. I agree with you on the consultation. They also want the element of surprise. And they did.
Right.
It worked.
Sure.
Yeah. 42 of those guys are taken out. Number two is, so when asked on escorting ships, the answer would be, yeah, because Iran is not just a U.S. problem. It's a problem, you know, to all of Europe, especially. And so South Korea, Japan, obviously wherever you get oil, China. So it's a problem. So we are attacking a problem. And when France comes out, especially France, and says, yeah, we'll do it after the cessation of violence. Really? Okay. If you want to actually go to the origins of what went wrong in Iran, you could say the one country that said, hey, Ayatollah Khomeini, if you need a place to stay, being that you kicked out of Iraq and you can't get into Kuwait, why don't you come to Paris? And then if you want to go back to Iran, I got Air France jet to bring you there. And now that has been a problem for 47 years since. And now you act like Donald Trump started it. That I have a problem with.
Yeah, absolutely. He was living in a lovely villa outside of Paris. And it, would the world be so much different were he still there?
So let's look at where we're at right now. If you are President Trump, I think you need a military operation to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the last major military operation. And at the same time, you need in the agreement to excavate and get out that 460 kilograms of your, or pounds, whatever it is, of uranium. Those are the two major objectives left. Ideally, they'll be weak enough that the people can come up and take their country back. But I don't think you can leave without those two things.
I think you're absolutely right on the Strait of Hormuz. I do think we need to get to the enriched uranium because there's enough there that if they were able to lay their hands on it, that's a big question. Can anybody really get to it? That's enough for 10 nuclear weapons and, you know, these people would use them. So let's start with the Strait. And you're right. The Europeans need this. They need it to be open. Look, where do you think they're getting their natural gas? They're getting it from Qatar. Where do you think they're getting a significant amount of their oil? They're getting it from the Middle East. And so this will hurt their economies as it will hurt our economies if this is turned into the Iranian-controlled strait, and the only way you can get stuff in and out of it is to pay them a tariff, pay them a toll. And this is where consultation, you're right, before the initial strikes, there was no need to consult with the NATO allies because they were not going to be part of the operation. Now's the time to have U.S. war planners and NATO war planners thinking about what resources can be provided by our allies there and in the Far East to help open the Straits of Hormuz and keep them open.
All right, Karl Rove, let's talk politics. Governor Youngkin speaking out on Sean Hannity's podcast, came out and let him know that the thing about Governor Spanberger is not that she's left to right, is that she misrepresented how she was going to lead Virginia. Listen to this exchange, cut 36.
I want to get to Spanberger in this sense. There's never been a more overtly fraudulent candidate as her. And I hated the big lie. Borders closed, borders secure. Joe is so cognitively strong. Oh, I'm having a hard time keeping up with him. I'm like, really? Then you must be in bad shape. Because it was such I don't like to be lied to. And Spanberger, I have no plan to redistrict.
None.
You know, I can go through chapter and verse. She never ran on all of this agenda that she's now implementing in your Commonwealth.
Yeah.
It's got to be frustrating for you.
Yeah, it's most frustrating for people in Virginia. Really frustrating for me because we had, I think, advanced the state to a nationally leading position across job creation and financial security and opportunity and safety and education. But now we see them trying to undo all of it. And it is exactly this bait and switch. I mean, this illegal and unconstitutional redistricting referendum.
Tell me about what this means. Is it just Spanberger's future, or does it tell you something about the Democratic Party?
Well, it tells us something about the Democratic Party, because remember, this was the big story. Mickey Sherrill and Spanberger were get the centrist, veterans. They were going to help drag the Democratic Party back to the center, and it's been just the opposite. And let's step back for a minute and look at the numbers. Think about this. She won the election 58-42. She ran 9 points ahead of where the last Democrat was 4 years ago, 5 years, going on 4.5 years now. She ran ahead by 9 points. Her approval rating is 46 approve, 47 disapprove. Now, that is a 12-point drop from where she was last fall. And not only that, but this is the lowest number, approval number, for any governor, and the highest disapproval number for any governor since this poll began asking the question in 1994 after George Allen had been elected as Republican governor the previous November. No number has ever been this low, which says the people of the Commonwealth reacted to what she has done, raise taxes, do DEI, move to the left on cultural issues, do this very egregious gerrymandering. In the name of fairness, we're going to take Virginia from being a 6 Democrat, 5 Republican congressional delegation to 11-1. And they're going to do it by drawing things that would, Eldridge Gerry, after whom we named this process, would be embarrassed at the lengths that they're going to in order to achieve that kind of realignment in the Virginia delegation.
So let's talk about the New Jersey race. Mikey Sherrill becomes governor. Her seat's vacant in the 11th district and has been vacant since she got the job. Now on April 16th, there'll be a special election. I find it fascinating because Republican-elect Joe Hathaway, a former mayor who is somewhat moderate, pro-choice, is running on law enforcement, ICE reform, job growth, so kind of up the middle. But this Anilia Mejia backs abolishing ICE, Medicare for all, no exemptions, expanding the Supreme Court, impeaching Justice Thomas and Alito, $25 minimum wage, tuition-free college, as left as it gets, endorsed by Bernie and AOC. Is there a chance for an upset here, or is New Jersey just a lost cause?
Well, special elections advantage, the hardcore political party. And, the bigger the turnout, the better the shot he would have. But in a special election like this, it's going to be tough because the hardcore partisans on both sides are going to come out. And there are a lot more hardcore partisan Democrats in this district than Republicans. But, if there's an upset, he's got the right message, which is I'm a responsible person who's looking to go down and represent you and get things done that make your life better. She is a left-wing ideologue, and you read just part of the list. I mean, she wants Medicare for all, in essence, free health care for everybody, including illegal aliens. So, she is a rabid left-winger. Democrats don't seem to understand that like Mamdani in New York and Mejia in New Jersey, these are people who are going to become, sort of representative across the broad span of our country of what the Democratic Party is up to. It's not going to be sort of, more working, traditional, to progressives and liberals. It's going to be these nuts. I mean, we see it in Michigan where they allowed this guy, Abdul El-Say, who's running for the Democratic nomination, brings in this guy, a social media influencer, who said things like, America deserves 9/11. Yes, Hassan Piker, who is a nut. But there he is, and standing there with this, Democratic hopeful for the Senate, who refuses to disavow any of his statements. And then we have Rohit Kahana, who's a smart guy and knows better. He goes on television and says, well, of course, we're happy to have Hassan Piker, speaking out on behalf of Democratic candidates. I mean, it is a sad day for the Democrats when they cannot bring themselves to say, we didn't as a country deserve 9/11. And, we should not celebrate the death of innocents on March March on October 7th and attending a music festival in Israel. We should not side with the enemies of America and with terrorist organizations against our country. And yet they can't bring themselves to do it. They're prominent voices in the Democratic Party. Where are they denouncing this lunatic? We're not going to hear them.
I know. I hear you. Meanwhile, Al Sharpton said, come one, come all, if you want to be running for president or even thinking about it, because he will decide. I guess you got to go kiss his ring. Governor Josh Shapiro showed up early. Here's what he said about him running in New York City. Cut 28.
And I think that that is a debate that our party hasn't had for a good long while. And that debate is not only going to help the Democratic Party, I think it's going to be healthy for this country. And what I can tell you for sure is that I want to be a part of that debate. Bring the common sense sensibility of what we do in Pennsylvania to that conversation. As to who's a candidate at the end of the day, that's for another day. But right now, what is critically important is that we have this national referendum in the midterms, and then we have an honest conversation as a party and as a country about what direction we want to go.
So what do you think? Shapiro's in?
I think so. He's smart to sort of, you know, do downplay it, because he's got an election to win this year. And if he wins a big election in this big battleground state, and particularly if he takes a significant slug of the Republican vote, you know, 15-20% of the Republican vote, then he's going to be a big player for Democrats in 2028. Yet remember, the Democrats, you know, in presidential elections, they tend not to nominate they nominated George McGovern, but they didn't nominate Bernie Sanders. You know, they picked, you know, Bill Clinton and won. They picked Barack Obama, who played like he was not a left winger. Remember, we're not red states and blue states, but United States. You know, it was Hillary Clinton, not Bernie. It was Joe Biden, not people to his left. So Shapiro, you know, this was a smart move on his part to go to this meeting. But he also, you know, was really smart by signaling, we're going to have a debate.
Right.
And we're going to have a debate about where we are as a party. And my suspicion is he's going to come down on the grounds of, I'm a more traditional Democrat, not one of these left wingers.
And people in Pennsylvania always call me when I say he's a moderate. And they said, no, you don't see what he's doing. But I guess that's for another day. Carl Rove, always great to see you. Literally see you on the stream.
Yeah, boy. And, you know, it's crisp white shirt, red tie, blue background. You look great. You got the smile on the face. Yep. You got everything going.
I do.
On the other hand, I'm hanging out in my little, you know, my little shack here in Austin, Texas.
Right. I think it's bigger than a shack. More on that later. Carl Rove, thank you. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. So when we come back, we'll be able to, we're moving on. We'll be able to take some calls in about 15, 20 minutes. But when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about what's happening with this, not only what's happening in politics, but I do want to talk about what's happening with Artemis. And Artemis 2 is coming back into our hemisphere. It's very rare these days when you talk about something and everyone's like, oh, that's fantastic. And that's the deal with space, which is ironic because they said one of the reasons we stopped going to space is because America got bored with walking on the moon. Believe it or not, now we have people who say we never walked on the moon. But in 68 to 72, we did it. Took a lot of pictures, took some video, even some in color, planted a flag, played some golf, and they said, okay, it's not worth it anymore. Let's do the space shuttle program. Let's keep it lower, let's give it lower space. Let's do satellites. Now people are thrilled with going back.
Is 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right. Joining us now, and welcome back, everybody. About 20 minutes, we'll be able to take some calls. But let's bring in Buck Sexton. He's got a brand new book out. It's called Manufacturing Delusion, How the Left Uses Brainwashing, Indoctrination, and Propaganda Against You. And Buck, welcome. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. It's going well. You're a guy who sells a lot of books, Brian, so you know. It's hard to sell books.
Right.
It's got to actually be good. But so far, The response has been really gratifying. People have really enjoyed it. The number one thing I hear from people is, wow, it's actually really good when you read it. Which is kind of a backhanded compliment, but I'll take it.
Yeah, I know, because people usually think one-page summaries. But, Buck, you just take your CIA background along with your political knowledge, and you see that nothing's organic. There's an intentionality to it, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So manufacturing delusion is really meant to answer one question. How do people get pushed into being so crazy? And I look at this from a bunch of different perspectives. And because, the subtitle of the book is How the Left Uses Brainwashing, Indoctrination, and Propaganda Against You. So I look at what's going on today. Like, why is your neighbor so nuts that he or she thinks that the world's going to end because of climate change, or that men don't have an advantage in women's sports, or that babies get assigned gender at birth? Because this stuff is all objectively nuts, right? I mean, we all need to start speaking about this. This stuff is crazy. You know, that men can have vaginas and women can have penises. Like, that's not true. This is crazy stuff. Well, how does this happen? And so I looked at this from the perspective of radicalization first and my time in the CIA, because certainly with jihadist radicalization, you see there's a process, a pipeline and an indoctrination that occurs to get people to do things as crazy as blowing themselves up in a country they've really never been to before, trying to kill a bunch of strangers. We saw that when I was in Iraq, I was in Afghanistan. I actually start the book, Brian, my first CIA assignment in Nigeria. I was just like basically fresh out of college. It's kind of random that I ended up there, but it turned out that was a very fertile ground for radicalization, and it got really bad in the years following. So I look at that, and then I also look at the history of all this. So you kind of get a multiple perspective answer to the question of how do they make people go so nuts? And I think it's really resonated with people post-COVID. We saw most of the country go nuts. So it's really important to look at these issues.
But it's almost like people broke up from being drunk, and they wake up and go, all those things are crazy. And then President Trump comes along in particular and starts running on common sense and willing to stand up and go, yeah, we got to build a wall. And you know what? The climate change stuff, it's a big hoax. And everyone's like, don't say that. But almost you needed a guy at the tip of the spear just saying what everyone should have been saying all along. He kind of broke the spell.
Well, yeah, this is my thing, Brian. We're not going to have Trump there to set right the madness always and in the future. As we know, he's already almost halfway through his second term. So I think because Trump was such a counterforce to not just the madness of COVID, by the way, but to the gender identity, trans stuff, for the BLM, the lies behind the BLM movement and the sanctification of George Floyd. Obviously, the climate change stuff has really fallen away. But when I wrote the book, which was over a year ago, there was still much more talk about the existential threat of climate change, the land acknowledgments that we do now. You know, Brian, I don't know. You're sitting on Iroquois land, buddy. I don't know if you start every show acknowledging that. You probably should. I'm on Seminole land. Probably should acknowledge that. So here's what I want everyone to know: this will happen again. It will keep happening. And maybe it doesn't happen to the whole society. Maybe it happens in part. But you need to understand there's a process. And I go through in the book, in Manufacturing Delusion, which your audience of readers and knowledgeable people who like history, by the way, there's a lot of history in the book, Brian. I go to the origins of mind control science with Pavlov, and then go through the Soviet Union and their gulag system and menticide, get into Chinese brainwashing, thought reform. It's a short book, but it's packed with a lot of history that people need to know, because there are things that are done to you, whether it's fire hose of falsehood propaganda, or it's isolation, or it's conditioning. There are things that are done to mold and even control the minds of individuals and the masses. And I think we need to identify what they are and know more about them, because it's happening to us every day.
So Buck Sexton's with us now. His new book is Manufacturing Delusion. Don't you think from the outside perspective, there is outside forces manipulating Americans against Americans? Even that we do a good job on it on our own, but don't you feel as though we're being manipulated from the outside too?
Oh, of course. There are, if you think about our global competitors and even enemies on the world stage, they have more access to Americans and to our thinking and to shaping and directing our thinking than ever before because of the internet, right? There's a duality to the digital world that we live in where, yes, we have more access to information than ever before. And all the great things about the internet, which there's tremendous fantastic things about it. But then there's also the flip side, which is that this gives places like China the ability to set up a totalitarian surveillance state that is beyond even what George Orwell could have imagined in 1984, certainly in terms of the technology deployed and the omnipresence of the system. So, yes, there are countries like China, like Russia, others that want to influence the way Americans think. It's a very powerful, very effective way to try to steer policy without a single bomb dropped or a single bullet fired. So that's, I actually get into places where a manufactured delusion or manufactured delusions are essentially running the country, if you will. That was certainly true in the Soviet Union. It's true in communist China today, although it's not really communist, but that's a longer conversation, and certainly in North Korea. And we see it in fits and starts in other places around the world. And you could think of it like mass hysteria, mass delusion. These are the same things. What happens to people, whether it's the 1600s and it's the witch craze in Europe, which, by the way, was far worse than the Salem witch trial situation here. Far more women were killed, burned at the stake. Why did that happen? Why is it that jihadists are able to be radicalized sitting in their basement? And how does that tie in? And this is what I think really hits people. Why are some of the tactics that I identify here in indoctrination, in brainwashing for terrorist groups, for cults? You see little bits of this in college campuses, left-wing activist groups, even left-wing media in corporate America. Things like the forced confession, the bending the knee, the profession of things known to be false. These are all tactics that are used to engage in coercive mind control, or really the most common term, Brian, is brainwashing. These are variations on a theme, but there's a process in this historically and today that people really need to be aware of, and that's what manufacturing delusion lays out.
Right. So in other words, if you can identify it, you could make sure you're not a victim of it, right?
Yeah, of course. Well, if you think about it this way, if someone's trying to get you to join a cult and you're sitting there, now that's a very specific example, but of course that still happens today. I talk about Om Shinrikyo, which is a fascinating and horrific cult, really wanted to bring about the end of the world. They're the ones that put the sarin gas on the subways in Tokyo, could have killed thousands and thousands of people if they had just gone about it a little bit differently. But I go through this and I say, look, there are these things, whether it's separating you from your family, whether it's forced false confession, whether it's exploitation of phobia, so irrational fear, all these different things. These are done to you on an individual level so that they can separate you from your previous belief system and make you think crazy things. And like I said, it can even be something like, oh, I put the black square up on BLM. I'm a big believer in this movement. And I think that, you know, 15,000 black men are killed by cops in America every year in a racist murder with no consequence. I mean, the real number, and it's not even clear that these are racist murders, but the real number is like 15 when the Washington Post did the analysis. But most Democrats thought it was in the thousands and thousands.
Right.
So you can see these things, right? You can see, why do they get you marching in crowds? Why do they get you chanting slogans? You see the way that people's minds are manipulated and used. And this is the part of it that's so important, exploited for reasons of politics. And I truly believe that this, certainly not climate change and certainly not, an asteroid hitting us tomorrow. This is the biggest threat we face.
Well, do you think there's a coordination between that podcast world that we're seeing on the extreme right and a lot of the messaging that's happening out there? A lot of people feel as though there's something manipulating there rather than people just getting clicks. There's an agenda. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, there's international money flowing into people now, not just on the left. That's been going on for a long time, but on the right as well. And I think this will come out more in time. There's a lot of blurring of what is a investment in a media entity versus what is effectively paying for an off-books lobbyist or propagandist, even somebody that should be registering under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. That's happening. We're going to see more of that, I think, meaning people looking into this in media. It certainly is going to happen, I think, when if you have a Democrat that wins in 28, because they'll be able to pick out people on the right who have started to coordinate their messaging with foreign entities in a way that is deeply concerning. I think it's more common on the left, but it's happening on the right as well. And if you can get people, I mean, what the best way to defeat America is to defeat us from within by convincing us of manufactured delusions, by slowly but surely chipping away at our sense of unity, of community, of what it means to be an American, of our Constitution, of our shared history. So these are information operations, Brian. I mean, if you're talking about it in military terms, this is psyops. And there are psyops being run via the internet on the American people all the time, externally, certainly, but using some of our own people, unfortunately, as useful idiots of Soviet lore.
Right. I also would think the anti-Semitism, there seems to be a strategy behind that. Where did that come from? Why is it everywhere? Why is that linked almost on October 7th and 8th? Why all of a sudden did that rise up when it should have been a time for sympathy towards Israel and the Jewish community? It was actually, it just bred scripted hate.
Well, when I looked again at the process, and I think it's so important when I'm laying this out, or when someone's reading Manufacturing Delusion, the book, which I certainly hope your audience will go get a copy of. I think they will find it well worth the read. Everybody that has come up to me, strangers, have said that they were surprised by how much they got out of it, how much they learned from it. And part of that is that process, Brian, of the steps, the tactics, if you want to call them that. I refer to them as tactics along the way. And confusion and degradation are two of the pinnacles, or two of the pillars, rather, of menticide, which is mind destruction. And I get into the history of what menticide is in the book, but more importantly for your question about Israel and what happened on October 7th, it was actually the people that hate Israel and the people who are anti-Semites, they viewed this as an opportunity to push even further. And essentially, we saw this in the U.S. in 9/11 as well, by the way, to say, oh, well, either it didn't happen the way that they said, or they deserved some combination of these things. Because once you are degrading yourself as somebody going along with this narrative that is so obviously and demonstrably false, you are deeper and deeper into the brainwashing apparatus, if you will. Confusion and degradation. Confuse the people that you want to control by telling them it's a good thing, or it didn't even happen, or even if it happened, it is a good thing. I mean, they just constantly change what the narrative is as long as it's hateful toward Israel. And then the degradation part of it is say things that are objectively false, but that's actually how you prove your allegiance to the ideologies. You have to lie about this stuff, or you have to say that, you know, it's not true, it didn't happen, or whatever. Because once, if you're willing to say the most obvious things are untrue, or the most clearly true things are untrue, then they've got you. Then it's easy to push you further down the rabbit hole of madness, of a manufactured delusion.
And now you have Democrats standing on the stage with a guy that says, we deserve 9/11 and October 7th didn't happen. When you have what's happening over in Michigan right now. So what happens is you say something so extreme and everyone's like, oh, of course, then Hassan Piker is not going to be acceptable. Next thing you know, Ro Khanna standing with him, go, I don't agree with everything he says. And that statements become more and more acceptable as you see people that you're familiar with standing with them.
Well, you know, we're all also, and the last chapter of the book is the future of mass delusion. And I get into the changes that we're seeing technologically, but that affect us very much day to day. You know, we are running a real-time experiment here, Brian, of people carrying around effectively propaganda devices at all times with them in their pocket. I mean, smartphones, whether it's social media, all the different ways that you can get information, and now AI, which obviously also plays a very, and it will play a stronger and stronger role in this. People's minds are being molded and they're being subjected to conditioning processes in a more 24/7 and constant loop than ever before. And we're starting to just grapple with this, I think, as a society. We're seeing with kids, by the way, you know, you saw that lawsuit against Facebook. People are recognizing, well, hold on a second. You can really do damage to kids if they're not being watched out for on these social media platforms. In terms of the messaging, I'm not even talking about people, you know, predators and people like that who are targeting children. That's obviously a major problem as well, but that's been known for a long time. But the issue in these lawsuits has been what it does to the minds of young people and how it creates a loop for self-harm. Yeah, that's also true, though, at different levels. Obviously, adults have agency and a greater responsibility to take care of this themselves. But it's happening to our whole society all at once. And the craziest stuff now is getting the most attention. And one thing, Brian, you know, I appreciate, I mean, obviously, I'm a fan of your work. We've known each other for years. Yeah. I appreciate that you stick to what you believe is true and what you think is good and honest and right. As you and I both know, That's not what always gets the clicks these days, my friend.
I know.
Say the most outrageous stuff, say the wildest garbage, profess the biggest imaginable delusion you can, and all of a sudden you're atop the charts. All of a sudden you're getting all this attention. The currency of the internet is outrage, it's mania, it's conspiracy, and that's just unfortunately spiraling. And it is creating delusions on the right as well, I might say. People are just saying wild stuff. I know normies, as we would call them, who are texting me, and they're saying, hey, did you see this conspiracy theory that's, whether it's related to the Charlie Kirk assassination, or it's related to Trump and Epstein, or it's all these things. And I'm looking at these people, I'm like, what are you? Yeah, of course we ask questions about all this. Yeah, of course we need presentation of evidence, and investigation is fine and necessary of these things. But, you know, the North Koreans are not working with the Venezuelans to get a space landing going to set up a laser so that they can take out, the J.D. Vance administration before it even happens or something. I mean, these crazy. People are nuts. The stuff they're saying is crazy. And it's troubling to see that this is spreading so rapidly. So manufacturing delusion is about how we stop this madness.
Congratulations on the book. Pick it up. Manufacturing Delusion, Buck Sexton. Congratulations.
Hey, man. Thank you so much, Brian.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
So, there is so much going on right now in politics, as well as what's going on with the war. And the Friday is going to be talks. It's less than 24 hours away, about where we go forward or where they go back to war in the big picture, and what it means when it's all said and done, with the election. Because if you can get the economy, if you get this war ended the right way, you get the economy just functioning the way it can, with everything that's been primed to do for the last year with this administration's policies, along with the tax returns that are coming now, you know, the deadline's next week, but really coming now and through April and May, you'll have a economy that's humming, and then you'll have Democrats being forced to do something they haven't done in a long time, and that is justify their vote, like fight for the vote. Because that would be interesting. Just a quick announcement, as I mentioned before, Uniting the States, the book I have coming out in October. Also have a tour along with this. I'm going to be in St. Louis, going to be in Westbury, Long Island, going to be in Jacksonville, also in Clearwater, Florida. I hope to see everybody in person. So go to BrianKilmeade.com. Also streaming on Fox Nation. Next up is going to be Reno, Nevada. It's going to be May 30th and then July 11th in a beautiful Pensacola, Florida.